Thank you, Leon. I'm not really an expert on spintronics. I like to think about the dynamics of magnetization, which mostly is done for insulating ferromagnets. But these days, spintronics includes insulating ferromagnets. So I think I might have something to tell you. And if you find it interesting, I'll be very happy. Thanks to the organizers for asking me to give this tutorial. I'm very happy to be in Santa Barbara, as always. This will be mostly a Blackboard talk. I'll show some slides and some videos, which I cannot draw very quickly on the board. But for the most part, I just will stick to the Blackboard. Let me first acknowledge people with whom I worked over these years. First and foremost, thanks to my colleague, C.L. Chan at Hopkins, who dragged me into this field when I arrived as a young faculty member at Hopkins. Yaroslav Bazali has worked with me on this from the beginning. My former students and postdocs, Oleg Tretyakov, Jiawei Chern, David Clark, contributed much to this. Benjamin Krueger was a visiting student from Hamburg at the time. And my current students, Imam Mahmoud's, Sekwon Kim, and very talented undergrad, Chris Monnier, have contributed also to various stages of this. The funding was provided by the NSF continually since 2002 for me. And I hope that the NSF will let me do some more of this. Let me also acknowledge people whose work inspired me. These are Stavros Kamenias and Nikos Papanikolaou from Crete, Jacques Miltat, Yoshinori Nakatai, and André Teville in Paris, Gen Tatar, who's here, Yaroslav Tsarkovnyak, and Grisha Volovic have done quite a lot on this. So here's an outline. I'll start by explaining what topological defects in ferromagnets are. I'll use the examples of a thin film ferromagnet and a three-dimensional ferromagnet with boundaries to show how vorticity and Skirmian number allow you to understand what types of topological defects these can have. Emergent gauge fields and its magnetic monopoles will make an appearance. After that, I'll go on to describe the classical dynamics of magnetization in these systems, which can be used to understand the motion of these topological defects, or vice versa. You can understand the dynamics of magnetization by expressing it in terms of the coordinates of various topological defects, or more generally of soft modes of magnetization. So we'll go from Landau and Lifshitz to Thiel, Walker, and beyond, using the method of collective coordinates, describe the three types of forces that act in these magnets, conservative, dissipative, and gyrotropic. And I'll illustrate this on the examples of a vortex domain wall, Bloch domain wall, and a Skirmian bubble, which is the most recent work, perhaps. So you should feel free to interrupt. This is a tutorial. Let me start by defining what a topological defect is. This is my favorite definition from Jim Sethmann, given at the Santa Fe Summer School a while ago. A defect is a tear in the order parameter field. A topological defect is a tear that can't be patched. So topological defects are various magnetic textures that cannot be easily removed. They're long-lived, and the dynamics of magnetization in some systems is described best in terms of basically the motion of these defects and their creation and annihilation. And we'll see how this works in ferromagnets. So here's an example of a domain wall in a flat ferromagnetic wire. Its thinnest dimension is thickness, which is, in this case, I think 30 nanometers or so. The width is 300 nanometers, and it's micron long, sticking out of the frame of the picture. If you prepare magnetization in such a way that it points left on one side and right on the other side, then in the middle there will be some kind of a texture that interpolates between the two, And as you can see, these textures can be pretty complex. In this case, you have a vortex in the middle, and you have also some concentration of colors near the top and near the bottom, which indicates that something interesting is going on in these regions as well. And you can move these domain walls in various ways, by applying a magnetic field, that's the easiest way, or by applying an electrical current that will be spin polarized. If you apply the magnetic field, then the domain on the left feels happy, the domain on the right feels unhappy because magnetization points opposite to the field. So naturally you can suspect that this domain wall will move to the right in some fashion, and the question is exactly how will it move. So here's a simulation from Milta, Tevila, and Nakatani, which shows that the domain wall is initially moving in a fairly boring way to the right, but then something happens some kind of a defect enters the ferromagnet from the edge, and the motion of the domain wall slows down considerably, so most of the action is now taking place in the transverse direction. Some vortex, or anti-vortex in this case, actually is moving across the strip, and once it gets to the other side of the strip, the motion of this domain wall will speed up again. So it's sufficiently complex, and one would like to have a simple description of this dynamics. So interestingly, even though we're pushing this domain wall to the right, it's actually moving to the left, so which is kind of weird. So this is what fascinated me for some amount of time, and this is why I'm interested in these systems. So let me begin by showing what topological defects exist in a thin film ferromagnet. So let's start with a ferromagnet that has no anisotropies, no intrinsic anisotropies to begin with. So here you have exchange interaction and dipolar interaction. And these are the only ingredients in this system. So if you have a thin ferromagnetic film with the thickness much smaller than the diameter of this disk, then dipolar interactions will create some sort of anisotropy that keeps magnetization in the plane. Just like in the long rod, magnetization likes to point in the direction of the longest axis. Here, magnetization likes to stay in the plane. Any direction in the plane is equally good, so you're dealing with some kind of an XY ferromagnet. And then in an XY ferromagnet, we know that topological defects are vortices. And so you can see several vortices in the bulk. They're shown by colored spots. The color actually is not just marking the spots. It also shows the direction of magnetization out of the plane. Right? If you come to the core of a vortex, magnetization has to escape into the third dimension because it does not know in which direction it should point in the plane. So it either points out of the plane, which would be red, or into the plane, which would be blue. And so here you have three vortices with magnetization out of the plane or into the plane, and an anti-vortex in the bulk. In addition to that, you can see that there are some sort of defects at the edges. There's a bluish spot on the top left and a reddish spot on the top right. These are fractional vortices, as I'll explain, and they only exist at the edges. They cannot exist in the bulk because their vorticities are half, or in this case, minus half. So here are the vorticity numbers, plus one for vortices, minus one for anti-vortices, and minus one half for the edge defects that are shown in this case. Any questions so far? So let's try and describe the mathematics of this simple system. I'll switch to the blackboard. So since we are in a ferromagnet where magnetization likes to point in the plane,
you want to switch off?
Yes. I tried to turn it off, but somehow
it
didn't. So magnetization, the vector of magnetization would be described by something like this. M times cosine phi, M times sine phi, and then 0 for the z direction. And we can define vorticity in the bulk in the usual way. So the number m would be 1 over 2 pi times a line integral of the gradient of the angle dot dr. So this is a familiar equation. So if you have a sample and then you follow the edge of the sample, or you can just have an infinite sample, and if there is a vortex inside where magnetization does something like this, as you follow a contour, the magnetization makes one rotation or two rotations or negative one rotation. So this is going to be an integer number. Now, something new happens when you have a ferromagnet with an edge. Just like anisotropy induced by dipolar interactions in the bulk of this thin film makes out-of-plane directions forbidden. In this case, the edge makes a similar effect and induces some sort of an edge anisotropy. So magnetization likes to point along the edge, but it doesn't like to point perpendicular to the edge. If magnetization comes to the edge like this and terminates, then it creates magnetic charges, and these magnetic charges will be sources of the magnetic field H. So you will pay a price in the form of the dipolar energy. So this is forbidden energetically, and therefore magnetization likes to point parallel to the edge. And so that introduces an interesting possibility. So if you have magnetization that mostly follows the edge like this, it might reverse the direction along the edge and make a rotation of plus pi or minus pi relative to the direction of the edge. So you will have something like this, a region where magnetization switches from this counterclockwise direction to a clockwise direction, and it will rotate through the angle plus pi or minus pi relative to the direction of the edge. So you can define for an edge defect like this, if you will, something of this sort, a number that would be minus 1 over 2 pi times the gradient of phi minus phi edge. Right? So if phi changes by plus pi or minus pi relative to phi edge, then this number would be plus or minus 1/2 for an edge defect.
So you take your always MZ completely equal 0, but that's not really the case.
That's not quite true, but we're staying away from the course for the moment. We'll get back to that. And so as long as we stay away from the core, we can neglect the z component. So interestingly, we can now take the vorticities of the edge and vorticities of the bulk and see that the total number would be a fixed quantity. You can see that by summing over the vortex numbers of the edge defects. So that means now you're doing the contour integration along the edge, grad phi minus grad phi edge dot dr. So the first term here will give you the total vorticity of the edge of the bulk defects with the minus sign. And the second term calculates the change in the angle of the edge, which is plus 2 pi. So it's that. And so by examining the right-hand side and the left-hand side, we see that the net vorticity, if we include both the edge and bulk defects, gives you 1. So you can have a state in which there are no bulk defects. For instance, you have just the vortex. Like this. So in this case, clearly, n bulk is 1. Or you can expel the vortex and be left with what people in this business call an onion state. Or you have two fractional vortices at the edges. So an edge in this case is plus half and plus half. And you get something like that. So it's a trivially conserved quantity. The right-hand side in this equation depends on the topology of the sample. If you have a sample with G holes, for example, so you can subtract the number of holes here. So if you have, instead of a disk, you have a disk with a hole, then you can have no defects anywhere. Right. Or you can construct the equivalent of an onion state, and it will have plus half defects on the outer edge and minus half defects on the inner edge. In other topologies, for instance, if you have a domain wall, in this case, the right-hand side would be 0. And so you can have a domain wall that contains just two edge defects, one plus half and the other is minus half. And it will look like this. And the minus half defect looks like that. Or you can have a vortex wall which has a vortex in the middle, that's plus 1, and then it has 2 minus half anti-half vortex defects at the opposite edges. Okay, so this is the two-dimensional situation. It's so
why can the domain wall be 0? Because there's a hole now? Or
no, this is not a vortex wall, this is a transverse wall, but
it can be 0, the number of defects. Or the sum of these.
No, the number of defects cannot be 0 because the magnetization has to rotate from left to right. So you're guaranteed that there are edge defects on both edges. So this is the most economical domain wall. A vortex domain wall, so let me draw the vortex domain wall, is the next most economical case. So you have magnetization doing this. In the middle, you have a vortex. And the interpolation goes as follows. Here you have an edge defect that is an anti-half vortex. And we also have one on this edge. This is a plus 1. And then it interpolates with me. So that's a vortex. That's a caricature of a vortex. If you
so
have
when do these walls become energetically favorable compared to blocks?
So this one is favorable in the limit of thin and narrow strips. And in fact, the cores of these defects are pushed slightly outward, so they're not exactly at the edge. These are in fact smooth textures here. And so when the width of the strip becomes small compared to the core size, then it just becomes a simple kink.
A kink.
In which the magnetization just depends on one coordinate. Right? So imagine shrinking.
It becomes a nail wall.
It becomes a nail wall, yeah, exactly. Oh. So this is a relative of a nail wall, but this is not. This is neither nail nor wall.
So you're saying when I start from a wide strip,
so in a wide strip you get this.
Well, you start with a block wall, I guess. If it's very wide, then very narrow is a nail wall, and you're saying somewhere in between you get these vertex walls?
So the vortex walls are seen in strips of width of maybe a few hundred nanometers. If you go beyond that, then it becomes very floppy and you can have several defects inside.
Or a simple block wall.
It depends. I'm not sure if you get a simple block wall in these cases, because a block wall will have magnetization coming out of the plane, which is costly. Okay. So shall we move on to the three-dimensional case? Okay, so let's now discuss a three-dimensional domain wall, or not a domain wall, but three-dimensional textures. So let's consider a three-dimensional ferromagnet. With a boundary. So inside, we'll assume it to be isotropic, but at the boundary, again, the magnetostatic effects tend to make magnetization parallel to the boundary. By discouraging the appearance of magnetic charges. So you have some effective anisotropy at the boundary. And so at the boundary, magnetization would like to be in the plane of the edge. It's not possible to achieve that. As you know, there's the hairy ball theorem. You cannot comb it. And so there will be some points where magnetization is not parallel to the boundary, if the topology is right. So if you have the topology of a sphere, then there will be several points, or maybe one point, where magnetization is sticking out. So the simplest configuration would be something like this. You'll have magnetization running in circles, and so at the top, magnetization might stick out or stick in. And at the bottom, there's the same effect at the south pole, say the magnetization can either point down or it can point up. And so you're guaranteed to have at least some points where magnetization is not parallel to the boundary.
I'm sorry, may I interrupt you? I have a question back to the other examples. What about the stray fields? If you have at the edges, these vertices.
Yeah. So here you will have some positive magnetic charge at this point and positive magnetic charge at that point.
So and then you have.
So there will be stray field coming out.
And they are not closed. The stray field lines.
Well, they eventually they will close.
Okay.
Right. So there are places.
They are not closed in plane. Or
so if you think about the charge of this domain wall, in fact, it's mostly negative because there's magnetization coming out this way. Right? So it has a large negative magnetic charge. The fact that there is some small positive magnetic charge is not particularly important. So you can close the stray field going that way if you put an edge here somewhere. Okay, so on a sphere, by using Euler's characteristic, one can show that the vorticity defined in the same way is going to be 2. And say it will be 0 on a torus, where you can have magnetization just going in circles without any singularities. So this is the familiar vortex or vorticity number. And since there are no boundaries on the surface, there will be no edge defects. But one can say that vortices themselves are now edge defects or boundary defects living on the surface. So in addition to the vorticity, there will be a second quantum number, Skirby number or Skirbian number, which we can define in the following way. So magnetization as a function of the position inside the sample is a map from three-dimensional space to a two-dimensional space of magnetization. So magnetization has a fixed length at low temperatures, so this can be reduced to two angles, theta and phi. So you're mapping from three dimensions to two dimensions. So this mapping will have many points in real space mapping onto a single point in on the unit sphere. Right? So it means that if I ask which points map onto a particular direction in space, say the North Pole, right? The answer will be, it will be a line of points. Right? So there's a line of points in real space, or magnetization points exactly upward. Let's say this is the line. That's 0, 0, n. And if I choose a different direction, there'll be another line of points where m is, say, 0, 0.1, square root of 1 minus n, something like that. So these will be lines in space. It turns out that I can define some kind of a vector field along these lines. So let's call this little b of r. And so I told you what the direction of this field b is, and let me explain what the magnitude is now. So let's take some point on one of these lines, let's say here. So I know that at this point, magnetization points up. And if I keep going along this line, it's stuck in this direction. So if I move along this line, the magnetization won't change. The magnetization might change if I move in a direction perpendicular to that. And there are two directions perpendicular to that. It's this one and that one. So if it turns out that when I move this way, magnetization, say, tilts toward me, and when I move in the third direction, it tilts like this, then I define a non-zero vector b here. So this is some kind of a curvature that I'll define. And you can also think of it in terms of the spin Berry phase. So what you do is you take these two directions, you form a little plaquette perpendicular to this line, and then you set on an excursion around this plaquette, and you watch what the spin is doing. If the spin makes a non-trivial loop on the sphere, your spin will pick up a Berry phase, right? And the loop on the unit sphere will be proportional to the area of this loop. Right? The area of the loop on the unit sphere is proportional to the area of the loop in real space. The proportionality coefficient between the two is what we'll call the magnitude of this field B. Okay? So that's some kind of a Berry curvature. So I'll introduce a unit vector m, which is magnetization divided by its length. And the mathematics of this is as follows. The field B is defined as 1 half epsilon ijk. And then there's a triple product of the magnetization and two of its gradients. So that's the magnitude of this field. Okay. So this shows that you have to have magnetization that doesn't stay in one plane. So for instance, if the magnetization tilts along the direction of the board, whether I move this way or that way, then you can see that this quantity vanishes because both of these gradients will be in the plane, so pointing this way, and you cannot have a triple product of three vectors that are in the same plane. Okay? So So all three vectors will be in the plane of the board, and this will vanish. So only if you have genuinely three-dimensional textures where magnetization explores both three directions, then you will have a non-zero Berry curvature. So this Berry curvature resembles a magnetic field to some extent, because you can show that the divergence of B is zero, right? So it's del I BI, and so then you have to apply the partial derivative either to this magnetization, and you'll have a triple product of three gradients, which you can easily see vanishes, because if the vector itself points this way, then the gradient can only be perpendicular to it, because the unit, the length of the vector is fixed, right? And so then you will have a triple product of three vectors that are in the same plane, and that triple product must vanish. Alternatively, you can apply the gradient to one of these, and then you'll have partial I, partial j, which is symmetric, and epsilon I, j, k, which is anti-symmetric in the exchange of I and j, and so it vanishes by that reason. So there are no sources of B, and so it's in this sense, it's like a magnetic field. In fact, you could have done the same construction with the planar ferromagnet, where you map from two dimensions in real space to the unit circle. And so then you can define your field as epsilon ij. M cross partial. And it turns out that that's the same definition as we had for the vorticity. So that would be basically partial I phi or something like that. So G partial J phi. So it's connected. If you're interested in seeing a much simpler example than this, you can work this out and you can see how that works in a simpler situation. Any questions about this? So I said that this field has no sources, but in fact, sometimes this is a theorem that's violated. I made this conclusion or this conclusion will be valid as long as M is a smooth configuration. Right? So if your magnetization varies smoothly, then there are no sources of this field. But sometimes you might discover that, in fact, there are sources if the magnetization is not smooth. So let me show you some situations where it happens.
Can I ask you a simple question?
Yeah.
So when you say a field, I mean mathematically it's a field, like a field, but what are with respect to what are the physical implications say to carriers? You haven't discussed anything like that before.
So I'm just softening you up. I'm making you get used to the idea that this might be a magnetic field. It's in fact felt by electrons that are moving in the background of this thing.
Actually, that you can prove probably by symmetry that this vector behaves like a magnetic field, since it has to be a color vector, no?
It's a pseudo vector.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's one more reason to think that it acts like a magnetic field.
Yeah.
So here are a couple of pictures of domain rules in cylindrical magnetic wires. This is stolen from works by Ricardo Hertel's group. So this is the equivalent of a transverse field, a transverse domain wall in a flat magnetic wire. Your magnetization more or less rotates uniformly as you go from this direction to its opposite. And you can see inside there are no singularities. Magnetization uniformly tilts. So there's nothing interesting happening from the topological perspective in this case, although one can say that there is a half skirmion, a negative half skirmion here, and a negative half skirmion here. So I'll show later that the top point here and the bottom point there sort of contain an edge defect with the skirmion number of minus n each, and they have vorticities of plus one on the top and minus one at the bottom. A more interesting situation happens in this configuration. You have a domain wall, which people sometimes refer to as a vortex domain wall, although there are no vortices here. You have magnetization that is smooth on the surface. There are no special points on the surface. It just continually twists from this to the tangential azimuthal direction to that, everywhere. Right? So you can work out the simple mathematics that shows that there must be a topological defect inside this domain wall, which is called a block point, or a magnetic hedgehog. So here are the examples of magnetic hedgehogs. On the left, you have a hedgehog where magnetization literally sticks out in all directions. And so in the middle, there must be a singularity because magnetization has no direction to choose from. At the bottom, you have hedgehogs where magnetization points inward everywhere. And if you calculate a certain topological characteristic, then you can show that one has a skirmion number of plus one, and the other has a skirmion number of minus one. The fact that they have different topological characteristics suggests that they cannot be continuously deformed into one another, but you can deform the hedgehog on the upper left into these two just by rotating the spins about the vertical direction. So these are all hedgehogs with the same skirmion number plus one. This is these are hedgehogs with a skirmion number of minus one. And the suspect in this case would be a skirmion number minus one hedgehog, which would look like this. So you have magnetization coming into it from the sides, and it's swirling like that. So how do we know that there should be a hedgehog inside? So what one can do is switch back to the blackboard.
One more time. That somewhere ni is 2, the vorticity, there you assume that the spins lie in the plane except isolated point.
Yes.
But if they are fully three-dimensional, then that equation, like this example of skirmion, then
that's the point, right? The surface has a special property that it tends to line the magnetization parallel to itself. Right. So at an energy cost, you can point in a direction normal to it, but that's an exception. So magnetization tends to stick to the surface. And in fact, when you examine all the vortices and anti-vortices, the magnetization is mostly in the plane, but then it points out of the plane, so in a core of the size of about 5 nanometers.
So these hedgehog configurations are not generally not realized, actually, because their spins always pointing.
Yeah, so in the bulk of a ferromagnet, it can point anywhere. Mm-hmm. But once you come to the surface, on the surface, it's not the case. So it tends to be parallel to the surface. That's where all these frictional effects come from.
This pericurvature definition, is it for a flat space or for a curve on a sphere? Is it defined similarly? Do you need to consider curve?
Yeah, so this is for three-dimensional flat space, right? So we'll see what happens when we come to the surface. The surface may be curved, but we have defined the bare curvature in this way. Right? So what one can do is evaluate. So suppose you have a sample.
Great noise.
And you can try and see whether there is some charge inside. Let's call it Q. That would be 1 over 4 pi. Surface integral B dot D2R or something like that. So if you do this for a sphere that I have previously drawn, where magnetization is going in circles like this, and then it sticks out here, or it sticks, let's say it sticks out also there, then you can evaluate what B is in this case. And what you'll find is that you can change. Actually, let's work this out for for a small portion of the surface. What I'm doing is I'm taking this portion of the surface, right, and I'm blowing it up, something like that. Right? So here I know that the magnetization stays in the plane far away from the core, and then at the core, it kind of sticks out like this. Right? So I'm interested in computing the flux of this magnetic field through this portion of the surface. In this case, the surface is in the xy plane, and so I'm interested in the z component of the magnetization. Of this big magnetic field. So bz would be 1/2 epsilon zjk m dot djm cross dkm. And so that would be m dot dx m cross dy. Right. So that's the z component. And you might recognize in this the skirmium density. Right. So this is 4 pi times the skirmium density, which is defined in two dimensions. So two dimensions, you know how to define skirmium density. And when you integrate this number over this area, right, so Q out of this small area is going to be, so it's 1 over 4 pi times this times an integral over dx and dy. And what this number does, it counts how many times the magnetization winds on the unit sphere. Right? So it's easy to count how many times it does so. The magnetization covers the equator when you're far away from the core. Right? So it's here. And then at the top, it points to the North Pole. And in between, it interpolates between these. So it covers exactly 1/2 of the sphere. If the magnetization pointed down, it would then cover the southern part of the sphere. And so this number is plus or minus 1/2 if mz is positive or negative at the core. So the vortices at the top and at the bottom can contribute plus 1/2 or minus 1/2 to the skirmium number. And I can tell you that if the two vortices at the top and at the bottom both point upwards at their cores, then you can construct a non-singular magnetization configuration everywhere. So basically, it just winds like this. And it gradually tilts from the equatorial plane toward the vertical direction inside. And so in this case, you can be sure that the charge inside, B dot D2R, would be zero. But now suppose we take the vortex of the South Pole and you reverse its magnetization from negative point downward. Then it means that you've changed this number by plus one, because you've changed actually by minus one. So you've changed this being from positive half to negative half. And so you end up with the, so in this case, instead of being zero, the Skirmian number would be plus one, the Skirmian number inside. So it means that magnetization is probably going to be singular at some point inside, and there is no way to escape that. Because if it were, then this Skirmian charge would have to be zero. So the bottom line of this construction is that if you count the Skirmian charges on the surface and in the bulk, then that should be zero. Okay. You can prove that just by taking the integral of B along the surface and also along surfaces surrounding singular points. Right. So everywhere else, the magnetic field B will be analytical, and therefore the integral should give you zero. So the surface defects in this case are vortices whose vorticities are plus or minus one, and the Skirmian charges are plus or minus half. And the bulk defects are magnetic hedgehogs or block points that are described by the Skirmian number, which is integer, plus one or minus one. Okay. So I think if there are other questions.
Yeah, QI defined for surface, right? Two dimensions. So how do you define bulk QI?
No. So you. In order to calculate the total Skirmian charge inside the surface, you take an integral of this field B over the surface. So that gives you the charge inside. You can also take, you know, if there is a defect here, you can just surround it with a little sphere and calculate its Skirmian number that way. So just one word maybe about this field B. It turns out that it does act like a real magnetic field on electrons that are moving in the background of a texture like this. If your texture is three-dimensional, that is, it twists this way and that way as you move around, then when an electron moves in the background of this texture and its spin follows the direction of the local magnetization, then upon making a closed loop, it will have picked up a Berry phase. And so that's where the equivalence with the magnetic field comes from. And so this is, you can define a magnetic field, which would be multiplying this by a flux quantum. Times this Berry field, Berry curvature field. So there have been experiments in which this magnetic field and the related electric field were measured. So I might mention the experiment by Erskine and Tsui that was done a number of years ago when a moving domain wall induced its EMF that comes precisely from magnetic field of a, let's say, a vortex that has a non-zero Skirmian number that moves across a magnetic strip. So let me finally come to the dynamics of topological defects. So we're running somewhat over time. So this will be a bait and switch. I said dynamics of topological defects. I'm going to describe dynamics of magnetization, which in some cases reduces to the dynamics of topological defects, but not in all cases. So if you have a single particle whose magnetization we can write as a unit vector little m times length of magnetization, then its dynamics is described by the Landau-Lipschitz equation, which is m dot equal to gamma, the gyromagnetic ratio, times some effective magnetic field cross m. So this would describe the precession of this magnetic moment around the direction of an effective magnetic field going that way. So m dot would be going into the blackboard in this case. And to describe the relaxation, you can write some simple term like this, alpha m cross m dot. M cross m dot points toward the direction of the effective field. So this is a dissipative term in Gilbert's form, where alpha typically is a small number compared to one. It's a dimensionless number, as Gilbert said. So for one spin, the effective magnetic field, say, is the just maybe the applied magnetic field. But this also works for more complex situations where magnetization varies in space and time. In that case, the Landau-Lipschitz equation still applies, but the effective magnetic field is now a rather complicated quantity. It's a functional derivative of the energy that depends on the magnetization with respect to the magnetization. And you have to multiply by m here. So this is a complicated object because the energy U includes exchange interactions, dipolar interactions, and isotropies. Did I leave out anything? Etc. So maybe the influence of currents and so on. In particular, the dipolar part is non-local, right? So the value of the dipolar field at this point depends on the magnetization everywhere in the sample. And so this is a nonlinear partial differential equation with a non-local kernel. So there's very little hope of solving it in realistic situations. And so one has to devise some approximation schemes that can help you solve it and make sense of what happens in the magnetization dynamics. There are two, I might say, well-known results. So there's Thiel's 1973 paper and Walker's 1974. So Thiel described the motion of a rigid magnetic texture, which does not change its shape and only changes its location. And he showed that if you can parameterize texture with just three numbers, x, y, and z, let's say the center of mass, then the equation, the equations of motion can be derived for these. And so the assumption was that magnetization depends in a simple way on just these three numbers, like this. So there are only rigid shifts. And in that case, the equations of motion that have three terms in this form also get three terms in Thiel's description. You have this, you have that, and you have. So the three terms express the conservative forces. So F is basically the gradient with respect to R of the energy. Dij is a symmetric tensor. So symmetric and positive definite dissipation tensor. So this is a dissipative force, a viscous force, and G is the gyro vector that gives some sort of a Lorentz force acting on a mixture. This equation is well known, and typically D is of order of alpha times G, so it's much smaller than G. So dissipation plays relatively minor role in this, and the gyroscopic force plays a major role. So this was derived, strictly speaking, for rigid textures where magnetization could be characterized only like this. But as Thiel himself speculated, and many others applied the strategy, this might describe the motion of textures well beyond this rigid texture approximation. And it works wonders, for example, for vortices whose motion is well described by this approach, in which you calculate conservative forces acting on vortices, and you stick the gyroscopic force and the dissipative tensor. So the
Interactions between vortices included?
Yes, the interactions between vortices are in this, because so if you know how the energy of the system depends on the location of vortices, then this gives you the forces acting between vortices. This is a conservative force.
So all the positions are from this.
So all of the positions are in here, right? So I did this for one center of mass, maybe, but if you have several vortices, which can be considered as rigid in some sense, then you can have several of these coordinates, right? So the gyroscopic, or the gyro vector is computed as epsilon ijk times a triple product here, so there's actually, there's a prefactor that's density of angular momentum or magnetization divided by the gyro magnetic ratio, and then there is this product, triple product, so which resembles the Skirmian number if you're in two dimensions. So generally when you're in a thin film, and your texture has a non-zero Skirmian number, then you have this gyro vector. If your texture is topologically trivial in this sense, then there is no gyro force acting on the texture.
And how is this force related to the Cherushinsky-Novian vector?
It's not. It's not related. The Cherushinsky-Moria would be in this part. So it would give rise to some conservative forces. As long as we're talking about insulating ferromagnets. So this only comes as a conservative force. And the dissipation tensor is like this. It's di m dot dj. So you can see that one is symmetric and the other is anti-symmetric in the indices. So as I said, sometimes this is highly successful, as in the case of one vortex and maybe two vortices and three vortices.
Going back to this equation, the first one, which is a more general one, m cross m dot. So what is known about its solution? So what data do I need at time t is equal to zero? Do I need m? And if I give you m,
you only need m. This is a first order differential equation.
But it's okay. I don't know. How would you do? Can you just integrate in time? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, which is what numerical integrators do.
The nonlinear part doesn't give you any problem with. I don't know how. I'm not very. I don't know.
No, so you can simulate efficiently numerically.
Nothing blows up or anything. Fine.
No. There can be some subtleties, particularly when you have singular textures like Bloch points. But as long as things are not singular, things are fine. So, as I said, the motion of vortices was described pretty well by this Thiel's approach.
Look, at the level of this Slavoljub equation, even things like Bloch points, right, are perfectly fine.
Yeah.
I mean, later on, there's the tricks you might run into issues, but at the level of this equation.
Well, Bloch points are special.
Yeah, so what do you mean? Yeah. Can you elaborate?
So maybe I'll elaborate on that later. So we have a preprint with Sacquon describing the motion of Bloch points. There are some interesting effects. That,
but as far as just numerically, just, you know, because that's what the question is. As far as just numerically solving this equation, you can just plug in an infection and run through. But you think that something.
So with block points, there is something special.
And don't tell us what.
That
too expensive, aren't they?
They're actually not expensive. Their energy converges. Their energy is not singular because you calculate.
But there, really, the magnetization has to go to zero. You cannot just go out of the plane.
Or you remember that you're on a lattice, and then on a lattice, you have magnetization sticking in some directions. There will be some high energy cost locally.
Okay, but then you really have to grating, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It turns out that for block points, the presence of an atomic lattice is extremely important.
May I ask a question again concerning the block points?
Yeah.
Isn't that, if you introduce a block point in your system, isn't that equivalent that you go to another topology of space from your sphere to
yes.
a torus?
Yes.
Just one?
Yeah, in fact, so there was an old, well, not very old, the 2007 was it work by by the German group that looked at the gyration of vortices in square samples. And they noticed that the rotation of vortices changed its direction from clockwise to counterclockwise. That indicates that the gyrotropic coefficient for the vortex switches. So you go from Skirmian number of half to Skirmian number of minus half. So that naturally should not happen if you have a continuous theory, but on a lattice it can happen. Because what happens is you have to, roughly speaking, kill a skirmion. You cannot kill a skirmion in a continuum theory, but if your skirmions live on a lattice, that's like having a hole in your lattice. And so you can basically shrink the skirmion down to the size of that hole and it disappears. And to dump the energy that comes out of this, there will be some spin waves coming out in a yin-yang pattern that you can observe in simulations. And the explosion energy is quantized. Ask me about that later. So vortices are okay. Here's another texture, a magnetic skirmion that should also be describable by Thiel's approach. So here we have magnetization pointing out of the board in the blue regions into the board in the red regions, and they're separated by this domain wall. So if you calculate the skirmion number, it's 1, because magnetization basically covers the entire sphere here. The North Pole is covered, the South Pole is covered, the equator is covered, and everything else is covered in between. So that's a plus 1 or minus 1 skirmion. And so it has a non-zero gyre vector g, and so you might hope to describe the motion of this texture in terms of this Thiel's equation with the gyroscopic force. With the dissipation and the conservative force is basically, it's a restoring force that wants to put the skirmion back at the origin. And so some time ago, Tony Blonde's group did numerical simulations of their motion, and you expect that the motion of that skirmion or its domain wall would just move like this. And that's precisely how vortices move if one calculates that. Instead, they observed a completely different trajectory, which looked like this. Okay, so it doesn't resemble that. The center of mass trajectory of this bubble resembled a pentagon instead of a circle, and so that was a surprise. So Thiel's approach didn't seem to work very well. And you can understand how that happens if you realize that this trajectory is a hypercycloid. of some sort, so this is a hypocycloid with the ratio of the circle diameters equal to 3, I think. And if you want to reproduce that, you need a ratio of about 5. So if this curve is explained by a superposition of two circular motions, it means that there are, instead of just the motion of the center, instead of just, let's say, one mode, which is simpler circular motion, you might have two modes. And you can reproduce that on a phenomenological level in the following way. If you modify Thiel's equation by adding some have an inertia term like this. So Thiel's equation for a vortex or a skirmium resembles the motion of a charged particle in the magnetic field. The gyroscopic term is the Lorentz force, and then you might have an electric field and so on. So what this does, it provides the particle with inertia, and you know that if you have a particle with a mass in crossed electric and magnetic fields, it moves along some kind of way. So it makes this kind of motion, and there's the cyclotron motion on top of some drift. So that turns out to be the right guess, and one can describe the motion of this bubble in these simple terms. So let me explain how this all comes about and tell you how one can go beyond Thiel's approach, which is something that we did in the last 6 years or so, using various examples. So instead of assuming a rigid texture, one can say, suppose our texture is described by some number of collective coordinates, which could be infinite. So we have magnetization that is parametrized by a set of collective coordinates, psi sub I, which themselves depend on time. So the time derivative of the magnetization comes from the time evolution of these collective coordinates. So if they don't change, then there is no evolution at all. So you have something like that. Okay, so if you plug this into the Landau-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation and then do the same thing that Thiel did a while ago, then you come up with the equations of motion for the collective coordinates, which look very similar to that. And they also contain three terms in which you have a conservative force, you have a dissipative force, and you have the gyroscopic force. So the conservative force is just the derivative of the energy with respect to the given collective coordinate. And then you can define what these tensors are. So the dissipation tensor is symmetric and proportional to Gilbert's damping. Whereas the gyrotropic tensor is anti-symmetric. And is independent of Gilbert's damping. Epsilon ijk in front, and then this should be j and not jk. That was correct. So these expressions resemble what I've written down here, and you can show that Thiel's results follow if your only two collective coordinates or three collective coordinates are center and mass. So that works out. So just by rewriting these equations of motion, reparametrizing them, you don't solve the problem, right? All you do is you just translate it into a different language. And so you have to pick the right dialect which will let you understand things in simple ways. So you need to figure out which collective coordinates to use. And typically what you want to do is focus on soft modes on the system. And that depends on which system you have, of course. So it turns out that for a vortex, for instance, the right soft modes would be the two coordinates of the core. And then there will be additional coordinates if you want to understand the motion of a vortex in more detail or on shorter timescales. So the way you pick collective coordinates can be summarized as follows. So here, this axis is going to be the inverse relaxation time. And I'm going to list modes, beginning with the slowest modes. So there will be some modes which have infinite relaxation times, or zero modes. And then there will be some mode with the longest relaxation time after the zero modes. All right, and then this tau zero is infinite, tau one, some tau two, tau three, etc. So these are slow modes, these are fast modes. So if you're interested only in slow modes, say in modes, so this would be 1 over t experiment. If your experiment is done on the time scale t experiment, then you're interested in only in modes that don't have time to relax during the time of the experiment. So all the modes to the right will have plenty of time to adjust to the current experimental conditions, and they will stay in equilibrium for the most part. All the modes on the left will be out of equilibrium, and these are the modes that you want to deal with. So the approximation then is to neglect all the modes on the right and concentrate on all the modes on the left. Okay? So let me give you an example, or three, depending on how much time I have.
About 10 minutes.
Sure.
I guess we'll have to go to lunch.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so let's say we have a vortex domain wall. Which consists of three topological defects. You have a vortex, and you have two anti-half vortices. So if you count naively, the vortex has two modes, or two coordinates, x and y. Each of the anti-half vortices has one. And so by this count, you would need four coordinates to describe this domain wall. And maybe in some situations you do, but there are situations where you only need two modes or two collective coordinates for the following reason. It turns out that vortex domain walls are fairly rigid. And by that I mean the following. If you examine the motion of a vortex wall, it turns out that there are a couple of constraints respected by this domain wall. So the vortex, for instance, stays on the line connecting the two anti-half vortices. So that's one constraint. The second constraint is the angle this line makes with the edge is about 45 degrees, and that stays more or less constant. So you can eliminate two coordinates from these constraints, and you'll be left just with the coordinates of the vortex core. So you can describe approximately the motion of the vortex core in terms of just two coordinates, x and y, of the vortex. So the description goes along the following lines. You can write down, generally for the collective coordinate method, I've erased the equations of motion, but they can be obtained from the following Lagrangian. It would include terms of different types. You would have this Berry phase term. You would have the potential energy that depends on the collective coordinates, and you would have the Rayleigh dissipation function, which is 1 half Gij x dot I x dot j. So this is the Berry phase term, which gives rise to the gyroscopic force, this is the potential energy. So the Lagrangian for this system can be written as gx dot times y. So this term gives rise to the gyroscopic force if you work it out. And then you can write out the potential energy as follows. First, the vortex prefers to stay in the middle of the strip. So y wants to be zero. It's repelled from the edges. So you have this term. And if you apply a magnetic field, the domain wall is pushed. So there's a force q times h times x. So this is the term that pushes the domain wall. One can write the dissipative part in the local approximation. It would be something like a number d multiplying the velocity squared. Right. So if you work out the equations of motion for this, then you get the following. So you will have the equation of motion for x would be minus gy dot plus qh and minus d times x dot. Equal to zero, the equation of motion for y is gx dot minus ky and minus dy dot equal to zero. So these are simple equations that you can solve. Let me explain what happens. So first, it turns out that you can neglect dissipation working in the transverse channel. So we can forget about this part. It gives small corrections as long as d is much less than the number g. And so then you can integrate out your transverse coordinate. At the expense of introducing this. So the vertical coordinate is equal to gx dot divided by k. So in other words, if your vertex is moving along the x direction, there's a gyroscopic force pushing it, and it has to be balanced by the restoring force. So if you take this and you plug it into the Lagrangian, you will have a Lagrangian that depends on x only, and this will be, it will look like this, it will be mx dot squared over 2. Right? So y becomes x dot, here y also becomes x dot, and then you have qhx, where the mass is generated by the gyrotropic coupling. So generally, if you have two modes that are coupled gyrotropically, one of which is hard, that is, it has a restoring force, you can integrate it out and introduce a mass term for the soft mode. So this is how it works. And so the motion along the x direction, then, is the motion of a massive particle in a viscous medium. And so you can introduce you can solve the equations of motion. There are two regimes. One is the regime with steady motion, in which the y coordinate is constant, and so you can remove this term, and then the velocity is determined by the applied field, so it's qh divided by d. So this is of order of magnetic field divided by the damping constant. So this requires that the gyrotropic term is balanced by the restoring force. So y is g times x dot divided by k. And if your strip has a finite width, there's a maximum displacement that the vortex can have, and that would be half of the strip width, right? So you have a maximal velocity that the domain wall can sustain, and that would be kw divided by 2g. So if the domain wall exceeds that velocity, then there is no steady state. And then you will have a vortex that is expelled from the edge, then it gets reintroduced, and it just oscillates. It keeps going up and down. So that's known as Walker's breakdown and other related problems. The oscillatory regime can be analyzed in a similar way, but this time we can neglect dissipation entirely. and then what you have is a particle, right? If we neglect this piece, then we have a particle moving in the magnetic field and a potential, and so it's going to be moving along equipotential lines. So the equipotential lines here are like this. All right, so it's ky squared over 2 minus qhx is a constant. All right, so if you remove dissipation, then this is going to be the shape of the trajectory. So your domain wall will oscillate like this with the vortex going back and forth, and it will not be moving at all. So in order to describe the motion now, you have to remember that there is dissipation, and as the domain wall is oscillating in this way, it wastes energy. And in order to replenish its energy, it has to shift down to lower potential energy positions, and so it will slowly drift. And you can show that in this case, the velocity would be of order alpha divided by h. So without dissipation, there's zero drift velocity, and the velocity will be proportional to alpha and inversely proportional to the field. So there are two very different regimes, velocity as a function of the applied field. So you start with a linear increase, and then at this maximum velocity, it drops, and then it becomes proportional to 1 over h. So this is how you can describe this, the motion of the domain. Well, you can calculate the various quantities. G is a fundamental quantity because it depends just on the Skirmian number and on very few other parameters, such as the thickness, for example, of the sample and the density of the spins. You can calculate the restoring force within the factor of 2. This is the least accurate part. You can calculate the dissipation tensor, and this theory seems to work out. So I think I'm out of time. So I will not go to other examples, but I've advertised them. So if you'd like to hear more about them, you can find me and pin me down. Thank you.
We could probably still take 5 minutes of questions, although we had a lot during the talk. I mean, it was so pedagogically presented, I'm not sure how many we have, but please, Garcia.
Wondering, at which point should we start worrying about spin wave emission by the fundamental motion?
Well, in principle, you can include the spin waves as...
Yeah, at which point did it become important?
Well, that's a good question. So here's, again, this diagram, the various modes sorted by the inverse relaxation time. So your x coordinate happens to be a zero mode, right? If there is no magnetic field applied, then the energy does not depend on the position of the domain wall. And it turns out that this mode has an infinite relaxation time. You apply a field, it never reaches equilibrium, right? So it takes an infinite amount of time. If you include the second coordinate, which is y, you get a finite relaxation time in addition for this mode. And it turns out that Walker's breakdown occurs pretty much when this time scale becomes of the order of the frequency with which the vortex oscillates. So that's what happens here. And so if you're at this point, you can stick with one coordinate. If you're at this point, you can stick with two coordinates. But then, as you increase the field further, you notice that your theory actually no longer agrees with the experiment. And you do have some sort of spin waves contributing. But these are localized spin waves. So in fact, the next sort of modes, I think there are 2 or 4 of them. I forget exactly what the number is. That's related to the motion of the edge defects. Okay, so you have the anti-half vortices that are beginning to ring. So each of them has 2 collective coordinates, it turns out, so you get 4 modes coming in at this point. If you're thinking of the emission of spin waves, if the spin waves have a finite frequency gap, then you don't have to worry about that until you hit that frequency. And so in sufficiently narrow strips, you're probably fine.
Hitting the frequency, I mean some kind of transverse oscillation? Or it's more like Cherenkov radiation, the velocity has to touch the spectrum? Like,
yeah, it varies. Yeah, there are...
When either of those things happen, then...
So, second one, whose work was that? When was it Hertel's?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so in a lot of Hurdle's papers, there is a point where you start dumping energy in the form of spin waves. And so then this approach no longer works all that well because you have a continuum of spin waves. Yeah.
Well, there's a simple comment. There's a talk at the ECO conference by Xiaoran Wen, also known as X-ray. He's insisting that, he's been giving talks kind of systematic over the last couple of years, insisting that there's important spin dimension even below this criteria that you just formulated, below the workup breakdown.
It depends.
Do you have an opinion on that? Or know that
it depends on every problem. So here, typically,
for the generic worker type of problem, he says that there's spin waves even below the workup breakdown.
No, I mean, if you have a finite sample, your spin waves have a finite frequency gap, right? So, and then, you know, what does it exactly mean?
So you think it's wrong, what he's saying?
Yeah. Well, it's not generally correct. It's too sweeping a statement. Sometimes it's a valid concern, but not always.
Regarding the hypercycloid motion of a Skonian, so what type of soft mode do we have to consider?
Oh, thank you. So, what you have to consider, in fact, is not just the center of mass position of the skirmion, because if you think about the center of mass, right, so this is our skirmion. It's basically a domain wall separating the up domain from the down domain. Nothing happens at the center of mass. So what one has to do is think about the displacements of the domain wall. This is where soft modes live, right? And so there are, let me give you very briefly the theory of such a domain wall.
Very
briefly. Very briefly, 3 minute version. Right, so let's forget about this circular domain wall. Let's take a nearly straight domain wall along the x direction. So it's described by two fields. One is y as a function of x. Okay, so that's the vertical displacement of the domain wall. And the second is, let's call this psi, which is the angle of magnetization that lives on this domain wall, right? So magnetization is out of the plane mostly everywhere except on the domain wall itself. That's a Bloch wall. And so here there's psi that kind of tries to track the direction of the domain wall because of the magnetostatic interactions. So it likes to point along the domain wall, right? So you have two variables, y and psi, and you can write down a simple Lagrangian for this, which is a caricature, but it actually captures what happens there. So there's, just like in Walker's problem, there's gyrotropic coupling between the vertical displacement and the angle, right? If you have a Bloch domain wall, then there's gyrotropic coupling between these two. So you have g y dot times phi, or psi, sorry. Okay, so that's the very phase term. And then there are some potential terms. There is one potential term that tries to make psi parallel or magnetization parallel to the direction of the domain wall. So you can write it as some stiffness times psi minus y prime square. Right? So psi tries to be equal to y prime. So if it goes at some angle, then the tangent of that is y prime, and so psi is approximately that. And then you can add, say, tangent of the domain wall, sigma y prime squared over 2. That's a very simple theory. It's quadratic in these variables. You can integrate out psi, and the equation of motion for that becomes g y dot minus kappa times psi minus y prime equal to 0. So you can eliminate psi, and if kappa were infinite, then psi would be equal to y prime. So you would always follow the direction of the domain wall. So psi would be y prime. But then there is a second piece, which is plus g times y dot over kappa. So you stick it in, you get a Lagrangian that contains no psi, but only contains y. And then it would have a kinetic energy, rho y dot squared over 2.
You're over 3 minutes.
Oh, I'm almost done. So it's g y dot y prime and the tangent piece. So if you analyze waves, this is quadratic in y.
you get waves propagating with one speed in the right direction and with a different speed in the left direction. So these are the modes of the bubble. So you can have waves propagating counterclockwise and clockwise with different speeds. And so the two modes that correspond to the center of mass motion are azimuthal modes with numbers 1 and minus 1. So one slowly rotates this way and the other quickly rotates the other way. So one of these modes in which, in one of these modes you have magnetization and the domain will roughly going in the same direction, and in the hotter mode they kind of go out of phase. So these are the ones.
Okay, let's thank Malek again.
Thank you.